It's Charlotte Talks from WFAE and on stations throughout the state, thanks to WUNC. This is a special two-hour public conversation, Unrest in the Queen City, 1 year later. We have an audience, as you can hear, gathered here at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater, and we will have them join this conversation in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn our attention to a national issue that certainly played a role in last year's unrest in Charlotte, and one that is a significant challenge statewide. Economic opportunity. Prior to the shooting of Keith Scott, economic opportunity was a focus for local leaders after a report revealed Mecklenburg County ranks near the bottom in the country for a lack of upward mobility. If you are born poor in Charlotte, chances are you will die poor here. It became quickly apparent that that black mark on this shining city of the New South was a factor in the anger and frustration which was readily apparent among those in our streets during the protests. So, what's been done to rectify that? Let's hear from some of those working on changing the economic equation. Dr. Patrick Graham is president and CEO of Charlotte Works. It's a workforce board serving this region of the state. They place over 7,000 individuals with barriers to employment in jobs. Thank you for being here. Nicholas Wharton is Chief Programs and Partnership Officer with the Urban League of the Central Carolinas. He's also a WFAE board member. Thank you for joining us. Sure. And Patrick Mumford is Director of Economic Development for the City of Charlotte. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
Let me start with you, Pat, because a lot of middle class and wealthy individuals have had their lives enhanced by being the beneficiaries of an economic inheritance. But there is a flip side to this that a lot of people don't think about and certainly don't understand, and that is the inheritance of intergenerational poverty, which possibly has an even greater impact on people in a negative way than inheritance does. How many people in our city are recipients of the inheritance of intergenerational poverty?
I do not know a number, but I can tell you there are large areas of this city that run from the west to the north to the east, where there are communities that have unemployment rates that are 15 percentage points higher than the average in this community. And you raised a good point that these are really systemic issues, and there's a lot of correlation to education, to housing, geography where people have lived, investment in those communities, and this has been going on a long time.
So if it's impossible to get out of poverty in Charlotte, and apparently that study is correct, it is, why is it so hard?
So what the study said is that it is next to impossible, not impossible, to move from the very lowest rung to the highest rung. I think what I took from that is that while that would be great, I think the more challenge is how do people just move up a couple of rungs? So go from poverty to where they can be self-sustaining. What is the reason for that? There are numerous reasons. I mentioned education. There's an incarceration rate that's a challenge for people when they come out. People have multiple barriers, and the two gentlemen on their side of me can speak much more intelligently to this, but have multiple barriers to employment. So when we have an economy that's thriving right now and people are looking to hire folks, they can choose people that don't have those challenges. So they are passed over in an inequitable way.
So I want to spend just a little more time with you on this, because this Keith Scott shooting, really, when I say it shook Charlotte to the core, I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think people were really taken aback by what happened and by what they saw in the streets, and not the destruction of property, but just the anger and the frustration. And several years ago, way before the shooting of Keith Scott, way before those riots last year, we discovered that we were very low in Charlotte on social capital, that people of different races did not meet really at all outside the workplace. This year we ranked 50th out of 50 cities for social mobility. We have long struggled in Charlotte with the dearth of affordable housing. We need to break up pockets of poverty. Our schools will be reorganizing next year to do that, or try to do that, because that's detrimental to successful learning. We've known this. This didn't happen overnight. These economic disparities have been around forever. So if we didn't do anything about those things before, or if progress toward fixing them has been slow, has it picked up now in light of what happened last year?
I would suggest certainly from a city standpoint and a public policy standpoint, there's been a really large focus on this issue. Have we moved the needle dramatically? No, but think about generational issues aren't going to be resolved in a year. But we've put together, with partnerships of both Urban League and Charlotte Works and others, the city is working to offer opportunity for people. Greg mentioned this in the last session, that if a child is in poverty and is not exposed to a work opportunity, how on earth are we going to expect them to go out and find a job? They don't even know what it means to show up on time, potentially, or how to shake somebody's hand to get an interview. And so it begins with small things and getting people opportunities to understand what it means to be employed. And then there's a continuum to go all the way through to full-time employment and sustainable.
Nicholas Wharton's with the Urban League of the Central Carolinas, and I'd like you to describe for people who live in Ballantyne and other affluent areas of our city, what kind of poverty we face in certain parts of Charlotte that led people who live there to believe that they have no future and that they have no stake in this city.
Wow, what a question. Let me start by sort of contextualizing how I see the problem, okay? Charlotte is 17th largest city, right, in the country. We have 10% of the state's population. We have about 30% of the gross domestic product of the state. But yet, we have close to 25% of the population that earns over $100,000, right? And we have essentially two economies. One economy that is thriving, in one even smaller economy that is in gated communities that are living well, sort of insulated from the kind of conversation we're having now, right? And then there's another population that is completely locked out of opportunities. The mobility study was clear. If you grew up in one of those five zip codes, the opportunity for you to move up is absolutely nil. Now, when I think about the circumstance we find ourselves in now, I understand we're here talking about the violence, the unrest that occurred, but there's a level of economic violence that's going on, right? That is slowly draining the life of a significant portion of the community. At the Urban League, we see that population as human capital, individuals to invest in, right? We're in a sort of mutual relationship, right? It's a collaborative relationship. Charlotte's a fabulous place for many, but it is really a dead end.
That's the two Charlottes that we heard about at the beginning of the program. So what does poverty look like for these people? What is it like for them?
Sure. Well, I think when you think about this, I give you one example. Last week, I was at the men's shelter. It's about 75 men there in their brokenness, right? They had chronic unemployment. They had families, many of which had disowned them. Many had addiction problems. Some had mental health issues. Many, though, wanted to have a good and full life. But their lives had passed them by because opportunities they were closed from. Like poor education, lived in communities that were conflicted by poverty and crime. But yet, they wanted to have a better life, but didn't have a road to make it. And these were men. 75 men, and I spoke to them about the opportunities at the Urban League and how a job, being able to feed your family, being able to earn a salary. Our motto at the League is education, placement, and training equals dignity. It's about a job. It's about jobs.
Right. This economic disparity that came to light a year or so ago in Charlotte came as a surprise to a lot of people. It did not come as a surprise to Patrick Graham, one of our guests here from Charlotte Works. And I want to ask you about how you were so prescient about this in a moment. But we have to break for station identification. You're listening to a special two-hour edition of Charlotte Talks, a public conversation, unrest in the Queen City 1 year later, on 90.7 WFAE Charlotte and 90.3 WFHE Hickory. And we're being broadcast statewide on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC-FM HD1 Chapel Hill, WFSS Fayetteville, WRQM Rocky Mount, WUND-FM Manteo, WBUX Buxton, and WUNW-FM Welcome. We are examining three areas that emerged as key to due to last year's shootings a year ago today, and to the disturbances that rocked Charlotte in the aftermath. We've spoken about policing and police relations with the community then and now, the role of activism in both protests and in helping to improve conditions and awareness in the Queen City of societal problems. And now we're talking about something that has become a nationwide concern, one throughout the state, and which has given the city in particular a black eye, the difficulty faced by many in moving up the economic ladder. So Dr. Patrick Graham, President and CEO of Charlotte Works, you are also the former CEO of the Urban League, and you wrote a book and you launched the State of Ethnic Charlotte Initiative, which predicted our area's gap in income mobility years before that current study that came out that we've been talking about. What made you so prescient, and what did you predict?
Well, one of the things that we looked at right away was that the economic downturn that we were experiencing affected African-American communities disproportionately, as many things do. And so when this economy caught a cold, the African-American community caught pneumonia. And so in many respects, what you see is that you lost half of your black wealth during that period. Half. And that was due to vulnerability of that wealth. But I also say this, if you look at this map, you all can't see it, right?
It's
you
radio.
You can't see this, very little. But what I want to show you is that some of the things that both Pat and Nick are talking about, right, and we talk about the economic violence, has happened a lot in Charlotte through gentrification, displacement. And when you look at this map, right, these are the highest pockets of unemployment. And they have now escaped out of the center of the city due to gentrification and have been spread throughout Charlotte. This brings all kind of infrastructure issues, educational issues for these people, right? And it also puts an additional stress. And when Pat was talking about some 15%, some of these pockets are up to 30% unemployment. Mm-hmm. You gotta think about that. And so how do you expect these people to thrive in a community where you have the cost of living constantly increasing? So I really summarize this in two ways. And I'm gonna give you two quotes. I'm gonna read them, if you don't mind, really quick. The grievance in their minds is the animus, the anger. And we're talking about protesters. Mm. They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. I mean, yes, it is a welfare state. We have spent trillions of dollars on welfare, and we've put people in bondage so they can't be all they are capable of being. The Honorable Congressman Robert Pittenger. What are we talking about here? We're talking about meritocracy. We're talking about reinforcement of racial hierarchy. But most important, we're talking about those who deserve mm-hmm. and those who don't. Yeah. And in his mind, during that statement, and that is something that we see throughout many pockets in Charlotte, mm-hmm. that there are those who deserve opportunity and those who don't. Right. Well, let me give you just one more quote. I actually talked to six individuals at our career centers, and I asked them to come up with a vision statement. And we talked about the many issues that they were facing. And so I help them craft this. And so this is in response to the Pittenger quote. It says this: we don't want to die for neighborhoods we rent, but live for communities we build and own.
Wow.
That's powerful. Mm. So you can see the difference in between those two. And the reality is, Michael, that we are right now in another reconstruction of a newer South. Mm-hmm. And that reconstruction is very similar to what it was before. The past reconstruction was one in which you also had, right, a renewing of our economy. So you gotta think about, we now have a renewing of our economy. But it was also one in which we had social disparity and actually even violence to control people and prohibit them from having the benefits of that economy. Now, I'm not saying that police and others do this intentionally, But what I am saying is, if we look over that economic violence that Nicholas referred to, and as an urban leaguer myself, and still an urban leaguer, I understand the language, because the reality is that we have an opportunity, and we have more than just an opportunity. We have to have will to actually create opportunities for these people and not have this type of thought as part of who we are.
Well, you use the word violence in relation to the police, and it's not just police that violence is, as we've learned earlier in this program, it's not just police committing violence on people at the lower ends of the economic spectrum, and also African Americans in general because of the color of their skin or whatever. It's the lack of opportunity, and it's the lack of educational opportunities. And God knows we've been trying to do this in the public schools, but not too much success in some circles. They would say that not too much success. The Opportunity Task Force, which was a 19-member council, studied issues of economic mobility here in Charlotte, and they identified what they described as three highly interrelated determinants most likely to have the greatest influence on the trajectory of opportunity. They are early care and education, college and career readiness, and child and family stability. What are your organizations doing in those three areas to make a difference?
So let me respond to that, but I want to catch up on something my colleague Patrick said about the quote that was so offensive, right? And I realize that the congressman has apologized over and over again for that, and I'm sure some people will certainly accept that apology. But what I want to say, though, what I really want to say about that is that the way that was framed, right, it also sort of presented a sort of existential threat in that. I've been in part of lots of conversations, many of us have, on economic mobility, roundtable conversations, and invariably the conversation comes to, if I give up something, right, if someone else gets something, I lose something. Sort of a zero-sum game.
But I thought a rising tide raised all boats.
Well, no, that's hope, wishful thinking, right? But that comment spoke to that in a very subtle way. Now, in terms of what we're doing at the Urban League, we have a sort of menu of very high-demand workforce development programs. Heating and ventilation, fiber optics technology, highway construction, high-voltage wire line workers, all these are jobs that you only need a high school diploma, right, to train for. Four weeks to three-month training. And these individuals come through these programs, right, and we have about an 80% job placement rate. So at the height of all the unrest, the city, Pat Mumford's office, along with Goodwill and the Urban League, partnered up, mm-hmm. right, to focus on hiring and training in those designated communities. And I'm happy to say that over this 18-month program, but we've trained about almost 140 people with about 60 to 70% job placement rate, right? So we've been focusing on making a difference.
And Charlotte Works has placed about 7,000 people in jobs, and I've forgotten the exact figure. I'm trying to find it in my notes, but I can't. It's in the millions of dollars in terms of money in salary paid to these folks. How have you done it? And what are the barriers to employment that are faced by so many people who can't get ahead?
Good question. Well, one of the things that we did is that we've developed more of an individualized training program. And so that means instead of having individuals, say, forced into a program, you're literally scholarshipping the individual to a training. Right. So we work with those individuals doing case management and career advising and actually direct them based off of their interest as well as capabilities to those industries. And we actually look, believe it or not, as industry and employers as our primary customer. And then match those people who are struggling with employment, right, with the skill sets needed there. And so the number you're trying to think of is that last year we placed 7,065 individuals with barriers to employment. They earned $103 million in salaries. Right. And what that means is that, number one, we know that people are capable, right? But two, I want to go back to something else really quick too, and the notion that we can provide opportunities for people with just high school diplomas is a great one. But I will say this too. Let's not overemphasize college is not for everyone only when we're talking about poor and people of color. Because here's some other realities. Information technology, which has over 72,000 jobs, right, in North Carolina, 72,000, 89% require a bachelor's. Energy, the program that Nick is talking about, was heavily involved with that, but I will tell you, out of the 2,000 plus jobs in that sector, in 82,000 in the U.S., 64% require a bachelor's. So my point here is that we often say college is not for everyone, but we overemphasize right. that in communities of color.
So given what he just said,
good point.
Given what he just said, Pat, and given that the city has decided to focus in the aftermath of what happened last year on three things, people, places, and business, it is businesses who hire people, and businesses right. need to see a result from the people that they hire. So how do you convince a business to take a shot, to give somebody their shot, to quote Hamilton?
Yeah, so that's really a subject that gets to the mindset of our community and this collective ownership of this challenge. So the way I look at it, when you look at all the cranes in the, on the skyline, you think, gosh, this community is doing really well. Everybody must be prospering. As we know, that's not the case. So how do these businesses that come to Charlotte, because it is a great place to be, how do they come here and own some of this? How do they connect with these two gentlemen and say, we're willing to be a part of the solution and hire some of these people, help point us in the direction of these qualified individuals that you have trained? And that's important for us to move this forward.
We're going to take another short break here, and when we come back, we're going to include the public in our public conversation, unrest in the Queen City a year later. We have people gathered here in our auditorium at Spirit Square, which we'll hear from next when we come back. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks.